Chapter 32, Opening Salvo. The sleep that night had been poor for all. The discovery of the assassin had set the castle on alarm, and guards swarmed everywhere. The Duke's household was awakened, and Brannis had been forced to cut short his already meager slumber.
"How did he get in?" Brannis asked.
"I smelled a bit of the sewer on him. There, plain as snow, once you get around the smell of blood," the guard captain reported. A low-born but competent man named Dern. He was dressed in the Duke's livery, but it appeared hastily donned. He had his sword belt on, but no other arms, and was unarmored.
"We lost 5 of our own, though we are still checking."
Frantic knocking on the other doors of the hall had roused the rest of Brannis's companions shortly after Juliana had dispatched the assassin. Iridan had slept through the incident, confident in his wards. Phelan emerged from his room with one of the Duke's daughters, though whether it was Demne or Phelia, Brannis neither knew nor cared. Phelan had constructed an illusion of an empty bedchamber to guard against scandalizing the castle staff, should anyone have come across them. Sending the Duke's daughter scampering off to her own chambers in a borrowed cloak had undone his plan, though in the chaos of the assassin's havoc, it passed with little attention paid. It was hours to dawn, and Brannis was already armored and content to remain so. It took much to rouse him, even after Iridan tore his door off the hinges to check on him, finding that it had been avalanche that had prevented entrance by less violent means. The sword's power was impressive. A ruined weapon would have run out of ether before holding off Iridan's efforts against the door. Being ether-forged, Avalanche was far more stingy with its ether use, able to function for decades or more with no maintenance. Ether-forged weapons were unfortunately uncommon, however, as the process required a rather skilled sorcerer to handcraft the weapon, imbuing it with ether all through the endeavor. Avalanche and Heaven's Cry were the only ones Iridan had ever seen.
"Well, anyone who thinks they can get back to sleep, take a few hours. At least until dawn feast," Brannis ordered.
Brannis was exploring the lower mines not half an hour later. The others had all gone off to their assigned tasks. None had thought further sleep possible, given the circumstances. While he hoped that the defenses above would hold, the mines were where they would need to hold out if they were overrun. The reported numbers of the goblin army worried him, and the number of the Duke's defenders worried him more so. Duke Peloton kept 200 archers, crews for 10 siege engines, a pitiful contingent of 20 cavalry, 400 city guard that would serve as infantry, and a militia of another 1,000 common folk who could be armed for Rainsdark's defense. That left him outnumbered 40-1, should the reports of the goblin host prove accurate.
"We have near to 600 ogres working in the mines," Menon suggested as they walked the ether-lit depths of the mines. The tunnels were huge, cut for ogres to walk 3 abreast, and they watched ogre workers pass by in both directions, moving ore out and empty carts back in.
Brannis was wary of the huge brutes,
though they paid him and Menon every courtesy as they passed. He had fought too many of them to be comfortable in their presence. He expected at any moment for the placid, docile look in their eyes to be replaced by the cunning ferocity he had seen, for one to just snarl and leap at him, take its pick as a war axe and try to cleave him in half.
"Would you trust these brutes with weapons?" Brannis asked, trying to lead the conversation to Menon ruling the idea out himself.
"I would just let them loose among the goblins with their everyday tools. They would hardly make efficient fighters, nor would they likely follow orders well. Not for lack of trying, mind you. They are eager to please, but have the intellect of house pets. Train them for winters at simple tasks, and they will manage them. Expect them to understand what you are saying conversationally, and you will be disappointed."
"I do not like the idea of them loose on a battlefield," Brannis said, stepping around a pile of loose rock that had yet to be removed.
"We can set them on the goblins if they make it as far as the Undercity, but above ground, I would rather try to hold the Overcity with magic and disciplined soldiers.
Minan nodded.
Now tell me more about the stone folk, Brannis said.
We ran into them generation ago, when my great-grandfather was a young man. Our lowest minds ran into their uppermost. There was an accident, and several of our miners were killed when the ground gave out beneath them. The stone folk were at fault and admitted such. They made reparations and we came to an accord on territories.
Have you kept in contact with them? Do you trade with them at all?
We try to keep on good terms with them. Last thing we want is a war with the stone folk living right beneath us. But we see them infrequently. They keep to themselves largely. We trade food for ore in the lean times, both ways. They are willing to barter iron ore for deep lake fish and the large mushrooms they farm.
We sell them wheat and mountain goat meat in exchange for gold, Minan said.
He was personally responsible for the city's finances, Brannis had discovered, which had explained his detailed knowledge of the city. Minan had to make sure it was all paid for.
Do you think they would grant us safe passage if we had to evacuate? Brannis asked. It was an indelicate question, but it was just him, Minan, and the ogre workers down this low in the mines.
Should I be concerned at where your thoughts lead? Minan questioned in reply.
I well suspect they would. The price would be rather exorbitant, I expect. But if we come to that point, I expect money will be the least of our concern. I plan for the worst. I still expect us to prevail. But my first goal is to ensure the safety of the people of Rainsdark.
Well, if nothing else, the stone folk might support us to keep Galen's obelisk out of goblin control. The stone folk may not trust us fully, but they know we have kept it safe since the earliest days of the Empire, and they like having it there.
What is Galen's obelisk? Brannis asked. It was the first he had heard of it.
It is an ether-consuming monolith in the upper mines, near the conduit of the volcano. It draws enough of the ambient ether in the area that the volcano cannot erupt. At least, it has not erupted since the obelisk has been there, Minan said. He was no expert in magical theory, and Brannis knew little more. It was an advanced topic at the academy, taught to students older than he had been when he had last attended.
Should I be concerned?
I think not, even if it were destroyed. Who knows how long it would be before the volcano became unstable? Besides, if the goblins gain control of it, we will likely be beyond caring at that point. Let the stone folk drive them out of the city and take control of it then. For a high enough price, we might even buy back the city from them, Minan said.
Now who is being the pessimist? Brannis observed.
Minan smiled for the first time since Brannis had known him.
Dawn feast had been light fare. None had wanted a full stomach once the news came from the walls that a thick fog had formed a short ways from the base of the mountain. Brannis confirmed what many had thought. The goblins had arrived. Brannis was intrigued by their choice of cover. Hirudan had used a similar trick in Kelvi Forest, though on a far, far smaller scale. With the Neverthaw right outside the city, conjuring a large fog was all the easier and would tax the goblin sorcerers rather little.
Stand ready, but do not cut short any of the preparations, Brannis ordered. The goblins are unlikely to attack until later in the day. They will have the evening sun at their back, and it is a clear day, so they will want us looking out into the sun during their initial assault.
Brannis stood atop the wall, overseeing the removal of all the catapults. He expected the walls to come under heavy bombardment, and the catapults on the wall would not last long against cannons. The officers of Duke Peloton's garrison had been skeptical, but Brannis knew that he would get better results from arcing shots over the rubble of the wall once the goblin infantry advanced. Ogres flowed up from the undercity, hauling cart after cart of gravel for the catapults to use as grape shot. Men shoveled the gravel into open sacks and piled them near the locations Brannis had ordered for the catapult's new positions. Heavy stones would flatten goblins surely enough, but such large expenditures for so few goblins harmed was wasteful. The gravel was often smaller than a cherry, but there were pieces as large as a man's fist mixed in. Any bit of it would be debilitating to a frail little goblin body, and it was far more useful to severely injure a few dozen of them than to kill a handful. Below, on the outside of the wall, Iridan worked with a handful of circle sorcerers that were assigned to Rainsdark, none above sixth circle. For all its wealth and old empire beauty, Rainsdark was a forsaken place in winter, and a backwater socially in the empire. Sorcerers were sent there as needed by the circle, but it was no prized assignment. Iridan had them gathering what ether they could, and shoring up the wards while he worked recarving them in spots where they were damaged, and making improvements where needed. Caldrax had been prevailed upon to take over Ruglor's task of preparing arrows for the archers, allowing them to reach the distant cannons. Brannis was unsure just how useful that would be, now that he knew the goblins were planning to use the fog as cover for their forces. They will have to let the fog lift to see what they are shooting at, Brannis thought. I would gladly trade blind shots with them, if the price is their useless cannons against our useless bows. Of Juliana there was no sign, which was as it should be. If Duke Peloton knew what she was doing, I might have a two-front war on my hands. The thought of burying his city beneath the Neverthaw Glacier would probably be enough to have him try to remove me from command. That is probably why Rashan wanted me to take command. I do not care for the city, but only for the safety of the people and victory over the enemy. They took their midday meal upon the wall, rather than heading back to the castle for it. The castle's cooks had sent up skewers of goat, soaked in mushroom sauce, and fresh-baked bread. The sorcerers working on the wall's wards came up for the meal as well. "You think they will attack soon?" Iridan asked between bites of goat meat. He had been in his element all morning. Ward-keeping was something he was comfortable with. The business of being trained as a warlock was new to him, and he had hardly even begun before his father had shipped him off to learn under fire. "They will attack when it suits them. Dusk is my guess. This late in the season, we have a few hours left, no more. In Kelvi, they made us wait overnight, but I think this time, the late hours favor them," Brannis answered. "When the fighting starts, head for the towers if you mean to remain on the walls. The wards there are stronger," Iridan said. "Where do you intend to be? Did Rashan say where you should position yourself for a battle?" Brannis asked. He knew that the warlock had taken Iridan aside and tried to convey the basics of his trade. However, where Rashan had generations of experience, Iridan was just trying his hand at the business of war. Kelvi had tested him and nearly broken him. What could Rashan have taught him in a few days that will make a difference? "He advised me not to trade spells from the wall, but to keep shield spells on myself at all times and get close enough to steal ether from the goblins," Iridan said. "I have always known how to use ether bolts silently, so that will be my standby." "You are going to wait out among the goblins as they charge?" Brannis asked, incredulous. He hoped that Rashan had not inflated Iridan's sense of his own power. "Not a chance. I'm planning to wait until they approach the wall. I doubt even Rashan is reckless enough to just walk into the middle of an army," he jested. Brannis noted that he still called the warlock by name and did not refer to him as his father. It was a lot to get used to, and Rashan did not have a very fatherly demeanor. "To be fair, my father never had a fatherly demeanor either." "Just keep in mind how dangerous these goblins are," Brannis said. "If you get into trouble, head for the Undercity. Do not let them overrun you or separate you from our troops. They will figure out before too long that you are a valuable target." "Rashan warned me about that as well. His advice was to kill enough of them that they started individually deciding that seeking me out was a bad idea. If enough of them do that, I will be the one chasing them," Iridan said. "You think that will work?" "It might have if he let me have his sword. On my own, I doubt I can be that fearsome. Who knows, though? Maybe someday." Hours passed after midday, and the sun grew low. Brannis waited. The lower the sun got, the more he caught himself staring out to the west, expecting the first reports of the goblin cannons. He was the only one who had recognized the sound for what it was. For everyone else, it would be terrifying. There was no helping it, though. The cannon was something that had no counterpart in Vaedrus. There was magic, terrifying in battle in its own right, and siege weapons, but nothing with the sort of destructive power that could strike from so far away it could not be countered. All around him, bowmen and officers waited impatiently, conversing in hushed tones and keeping wary eyes on the fog. Fog was not so uncommon around Rainsdark, but even the most skeptical among the soldiers was convinced that the goblins lay beneath that misty blanket, and that the fog was magical. Real fog would have burned off in the late morning.
Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
There was no warning, no preamble. The air erupted in metal. Low overhead, the whistle of the cannon shots sped by, the shots themselves moving too fast to be seen. There was a crash among the stone buildings of the city where the cannonballs had found a place to cease their flight, though not their intended target. Nearly everyone on the walls moved to the city side to see what had just befallen. Homes had largely been struck in the first volley, with a smithy taking a shot as well. The sturdy stone construction of Rainsdark's buildings, many of them hundreds of summers old or more, was no match for the goblin version of Akkadian cannons.
"Stay low. Wait for them to lift the fog. They are firing blindly at us," Brannis yelled out a warning to everyone on the wall.
Following Iridan's advice, he made his way along the wall to one of the larger defensive towers that had sported a catapult earlier that day. Without the catapult crews in the way, the tower was an excellent vantage point.
Burp, 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 burp.
The sound of the horn echoed among the mountains. Brannis's eyes widened in comprehension. They have a spotter.
"Look to the fields. Find where that horn is sounding from," Brannis shouted.
Men were already rushing to the very edge of the wall to seek out the source of the noise. The fresh fallen snow should have made picking out the goblin spotter easier, but the distance was working against them, and the goblin may have used magic to cover his tracks.
Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
The volley was less dangerous than the first, smashing into the road leading up to the city. The shots hit various switchbacks, but all were low by roughly the height of the wall. The goblins were adjusting their aim by the spotter's signal.
Burp, burp, burp.
"Iridan, bring one of those metal balls up here," Brannis called out, just stopping himself before calling it a cannonball. "And someone fetch Phelan, and quickly."
Brannis had an idea how to play the goblins' blindness against them. If they could fool the spotter, they would not need to find him and kill him.
Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
Brannis ducked instinctively as the sound of the shots passed close next to him. There was a wet, splattering sound, and one of the archers on the wall nearby was gone. Two other shots had clipped the top of the wall, shattering stone despite the wards.
"This is not good. I had hoped that the wards would have done more."
"Brannis, here!"
Iridan shouted. Brannis turned to see a bronze sphere floating his way. Brannis caught the goblin's cannonball as it came close. It was still hot and would have burned his hand if not for the protection his gauntlet offered. It was identical in size to the ones he had seen aboard the Fair Trader. He turned it over and around, studying the runes carved into it. He was no expert on runes, but these seemed meant to damage the wards that the walls bore. The cannonball was even in good shape after its impact. It could probably be used again without having to be tended to by a smith.
"Where is Phelan?"
Brannis shouted, finding renewed urgency in misleading the goblin spotter.
"If we cannot get them to miss the wall, it will not last long."
The accursed horn sounded again.
Brr, brr.
Brannis could only hope that they could get Phelan to the wall before the goblins found their range and brought it down around them. We need to get the goblins to commit to a charge while the wall is still intact. Then,
ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
The tower where Brannis stood shook under the direct impact of at least two of the shots. The goblins were on target. The tower's wards held, but the wall had not been so lucky. Plumes of stone dust rose skyward as the cannonballs made holes in several places. Some spots just cracked as the wards spent themselves protecting the walls, but not enough wards were holding.
Damn it, Iridan. Was that all that could be done to shore up those runes?
Sir Brannis, Phelan yelled.
He was out of breath after being brought back from the safety of the castle and climbing the ladder up to the wall.
Quickly, hide that dust cloud. We need to have the goblins think they missed, Brannis ordered.
It may have been too late already, but it was their best chance. If they adjusted their aim again, they might be able to convince them they were hitting wall when all they were destroying was the road below.
Huaxti, Janedu, Deldor, Wanetexu, Ilu, Mulaftu, Sikidori, Pukanzu, Margek, Lotak, Jonubi, Phelan chanted quickly.
He seemed to paint the air with his fingers, creating an image of clear air in front of the debris made by the cannonball's impact.
It was a much longer incantation than Brannis was used to hearing.
But he knew little of illusion, and could see how it might need to be a bit more intricate than turning ether into fire or wind.
No way am I going to remember all that. I could barely follow it. That is, if I live to see nightfall at all for Kyrus to make use of the knowledge.
Brannis had to remind himself that there was a horde of goblins who were intent on destroying them, and it was not a foregone conclusion that he would see the next day. Brannis and the other Kadrin defenders had no perspective that would let them see how the goblins were perceiving Phelan's illusion. The ether construct of a patch of clear air painted in the sky was set between the debris cloud and the goblin fog shroud. They waited. After a long while, the horn sounded again. The spotter must have been confused.
Burp, burp, burp.
Brannis wished he had been better able to pick out a pattern in the trumpeting. He wanted to know whether he was going to be seeing cannonballs crashing into the rocks below the wall or ducking ones near his head. There was nothing to do but wait. The soldiers along the wall were becoming accustomed to the pattern and hunkered down behind the parapets after the horn's call faded.
Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
The ground shook, but not like it had before. Brannis looked over to see that the shots had missed low. The cannons were striking at the rock just below the base of the wall. A few shots had ricocheted into the wall itself, but the wards had held against the reduced impact.
Phelan, show them that they hit. Unmask the debris cloud. Make it more visible if you can, Brannis ordered.
Consider it done, Phelan replied.
They toyed with the goblins for volley after volley. They seemed to be catching on that something was wrong, but the goblin spotter was guessing against them and losing. Phelan adjusted the visible debris and created the appearance of damage where there was none, or revealed earlier damage from the errant shots that occasionally slipped through their web of deceptions and hit the wall anyway. Brannis wished there was someone that could lend aid to Phelan, but there was no one else who had more than a basic understanding of illusion. It was an ill-reputed discipline, and a highly specialized one. Illusion attracted few to its way. Brannis could see the strain it was putting on the slightly built sorcerer's body. It thus came as no surprise when Phelan collapsed unconscious after one more time having to renew his spell for painting the sky with lies.
Quickly, get him into town, Brannis said. Get him water and lay him down. If you can rouse him, help him back to the battle.
This is it. The goblins are going to figure out their range, and we will lose the wall.
Brannis had expected it, but it was no less galling to be driven back. Still, they had not lost the wall yet. and it was possible that they might have run the goblins out of, or at least low on, ammunition or black powder.
Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom. Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom. Ka-thoom, 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 ka-thoom.
There was little they could do but wait it out, and hope the wall still offered some protection when the goblins ran out of shots to fire, or patience, and attacked. Looking out the flap of the tent, Celia could see little in the heavy magical fog. There was visibility to a dozen paces or so, but that only showed her the commanders and the Magrin sorcerer. He had taken her again that morning, a final human comfort before going into battle beside the goblins. He whispered promises that he would protect her, and for the first time, spoke of not ransoming her back to Cadran at all. He said he wanted to bring her back to Magrin with him after conquering Rainsdark, and take her for a wife. She would be his fourth wife, he said, and rich as a princess. There is no future in Cadran as a sorceress, he had said. She was oddly conflicted. Jinzan had been the only one kind to her in the least since the goblin invasion. Her husband had died trying to flee the city without her, and had been caught by the goblin invaders. He was Lord Feldrake's guard captain and had disgraced himself badly. He had talked bravely, but after a few short months of marriage, she had discovered that he was just a braggart and a bully. And on the day he died, she realized he was a coward who would abandon her to save his own hide. Jinzan was a hero among his people. He had fought for and won his people's freedom. He was ruthless, but he was also intelligent and brave in the true sense, backed by actions and not just idle words. Enemy or not, he was more a man than her late husband, and she was now widowed. Can Magrin really retake not only their own lands, but steal Cadran's as well? An alliance with goblins and the marvelous war machines they had made from Jinzan's plans spoke to a shift in power in favor of the mistreated former vassal. She had been hearing the cannons, as he called them, for nearly an hour. The noise they made was unlike thunder, which was loud but lasted and faded. These cannons split the air itself with their report. She learned after the first volley to wait for the spotter's horn, then plug her ears. At least they had left her hands unbound. She did not know whether it was arrogance or oversight. Jinzan had taken no chances with her, certainly. She had slept the night gagged and with her wrists and even fingers tied together. He would treat her as a dangerous enemy, he had told her, until she had chosen her fate. If she agreed to return to Magrin with him, he promised there would be no more need for such precautions. She believed him, too. She had seen his source and seen his draw. He was far more powerful than Celia, and she knew it. I wonder how he would treat me if he knew I was fifth circle and not seventh, Celia mused. She had lied to keep from being considered even more dangerous than a lesser-ranked sorceress would be. Her source looked weaker than it truly was, due to her aptitude at life extension. Diverting much of her source into preserving her youth limited her power, but it was well worth it in her mind. She was 7 springtimes older than she claimed, but looked young enough for the 19 autumns she pretended to be. For the young sorceresses of Cadran, it was never too early to begin preserving their looks. Still, despite summers of habit, she could stop diverting so much of her source to keeping her youth, and instead try to ambush Jinzan. It would cost winters off her life, perhaps. Life extension was like a dam, and unleashing it would cause much trouble that could not be quickly or completely undone. But she could be a hero to Cadran. If we win, she amended to herself. If things went badly, maybe she would consider his offer.
I grow weary, Nehashtak muttered,
heeding the warning Githak had given her about remaining quiet to retain the element of surprise. She understood the logic of it and was rather enjoying the sound of Kikart's new toys. But it was cold outside, and while dragons were warm-blooded and she was in no danger of hypothermia, as were her minions, she longed for the comfort of volcanic caverns. The city was peopled by humans, with their knights and sorcerers, and according to Gaklar, at least, a demon. Aside from the last, the rest barely registered as threats, and she did not fear the demon.
"Patience, my Diwan," Githak advised.
His lesser-ranked generals had taken over conducting the battle as soon as she had arrived. Githak had devoted his energies to trying to placate her and keep her amused while her worshippers dallied about in their conquest of the human city. There was nothing he could do, either by law or through force, to stop her seizing his army from him if she tired of waiting for him to deliver the city.
"We do not wish to waste any of our troops. Let the Tinker's weapons do their work on the Cadron's defenses first."
"Send my masseurs. I wish my wings readied for flight,"
Nehashtak instructed, thinking that once she felt up to it, she would join the battle. It had been some winters since she last flew anything other than lazy loops around her lair to enjoy fine weather or to awe her worshippers on holy days. Her muscles ought to be worked loose before testing them in combat. Githak relayed the order and added a few of his own. He could sense her impatience, she could tell. He was an attentive and perceptive minion. While Nehashtak was utterly confident in her imperviousness, Githak was cautious and wished to conduct a proper military operation with few risks and total victory, or so he claimed. Goblins would need to live in that city when they were done conquering it, and raising it with dragonfire was counterproductive, or so he claimed. Githak plugged his ears.
"Kathoom, kathoom, kathoom, kathoom."
Nehashtak clenched her jaw tight to keep from wincing at the sound, which was beginning to wear on her as much as her general's empty claims. How many more such volleys would she have to put up with before she took matters into her own claws?
"Wolves!"
The shout came and then was carried down the wall. Defenders poked their heads above the ruins of the wall, wherever they could find shelter. Brannis had ordered the evacuation of the wall, except for a handful of lookouts, who were posted on the highest remaining points of the wall. Ladders had been moved into place based on where there was still a place worth climbing. All four of the wall's towers had been damaged beyond the point where any sane soldier would man them. Thus only a handful remained stationed there, Iridan among them. The would-be warlock was weary of being shot at by unseen engines of war and hungered to show off the real trick his warlock father had taught him during his brief tutelage.
"Man the walls," Brannis ordered.
Soldiers and militia alike took up spears and climbed the ruins of the wall to gain the hilltop they now formed. Men helped one another up by clasped wrists and knees used as stepladders, any method they could find to get in place to finally face their enemy on the field of battle. Those at the top saw what appeared to be a stampede of wolves, black-furred and near to the height of a horse. These were Nehashtak's outriders, though none of the defenders could have known that. For the last 2 days, the Rainsdark scouts who ventured beyond sight of the city walls were overrun and killed by these same packs of monstrous wolves and their riders. The wolves carried the goblin equivalent of light cavalry, armed with spears and daggers. They were having no difficulty traversing the snow-dusted plains that filled the void between the Cadron defenders and the main goblin host. The wolves were equipped for battle, with steel helmets that were fanned out at the edges to offer a semicircular screen for the rider to duck behind for cover. Thick leather collars and vests protected their vulnerable necks and underbellies. Goblins left little they dealt with unimproved. Their animals were no exception. The wolves threw up great sprays of powdery snow as they ran,
seemingly extending the cloud of fog as they ran.
But as the snow fell back upon the earth, it revealed goblins on foot, following in the path trampled by the wolves. The goblins did not hoot and cheer as humans might as they charged into battle. Their tiny voices did not carry far enough, or with enough resonance, to strike fear into enemies' hearts, and they knew it. Thus onward they came, with just the panting of wolves as their herald. still too far away to be heard by their enemies, yet closing rapidly. Men upon the remains of Rainsdark's battlements shifted nervously and tightened grips on their spears. On the bit of walls and tower that remained, archers arrayed themselves as best they could manage to steady a shot.
"Archers, fire on the wolves as they come into range. Save the enchanted arrows for now," Brennus shouted.
Bows twanged as the archers took that for liberty to begin firing immediately, and some of the arrows reached their mark. The view from atop the avalanche wall was breathtaking. Higher than even the top towers of the castle, Juliana could see out over the entire battlefield, though she still could not see what was concealed in the fog.
"They must keep their command back there, and obviously there are the cannons. But what else are they hiding? They must have either some trick, or keeping the fog up is just a waste of ether."
The runes were damaged along a long stretch of the avalanche wall. She had struggled with disabling the physical protections of the surface long enough to damage the wards that bore the weight of the Neverthaw Glacier above. She wondered how old the wall was. It was weathered and water-stained, but in perfectly functional condition. She had never been a strong student of history, but she had gathered that the wall was probably nearly as old as the city itself, thousands of summers. Juliana felt a pang of regret at what she might have just set on a path to destruction. One day, history books might list her as the one who had destroyed Rainsdark's ancient wall, a monument to the early days of the Empire.
"But will they see me as a vandal, recklessly toppling a piece of the Empire's heritage? Or as the savior who is willing to place the lives of everyone in Rainsdark ahead of the architectural richness of their forebears?"
She watched for a moment longer, fascinated by the battle unfolding so far off. The forces arrayed on both sides looked like tiny ceramic figurines sold in the markets, little clusters of toy people and goblins, too small to be real, but so amazingly lifelike in their detail. It was easy to ignore the fact that the figures breathed and bled and screamed when seen from so far away. Suddenly the plains erupted in flame. A huge swath of the pack of charging wolves turned into living flame. The charge broke off and diverted around the destruction, but kept coming.
"Unless that worm Kaldrax did that, Iridan must have just cast that firestorm spell. That was no fire hurling. Not on that scale, for sure. Just be safe, please, Iridan. You are not your father. Fate willing, you never will be."
"I sense that," Nehashtak snarled,
sending Githak and the Masseurs stumbling away from her reflexive shift to an alert posture.
"Mighty one, I understand your desire for combat. I cannot see any reason you should not join the battle at your leisure. I know you are supremely powerful, but please have care, Holy One. This human feels powerful, and I do not wish to see you injured,"
Githak said, trying to instill some thought of caution in his arrogant goddess. She knew that she would be fine, and wished that her followers would show a bit more confidence in her power. Githak, she suspected, was more concerned over the damage she might inflict on his new city.
"So it seems the demon has joined the battle. If the great beast wishes to confront the thing directly, so be it. It seems strong enough, though I imagine I could hold my own against it, if that is the extent of its power."
Jinzan had spent most of the day pacing. He needed access to the city and did not want to risk open battle if he could at all avoid it. His mission was more important than the overall conquest. The staff of Galen was all that mattered.
Well, maybe not all that matters. The loss of the Rainsdark mines will hurt the Empire, though not fatally. There is the girl, too.
It was a silly, impulsive decision, he knew. Before he had known she was a spy, he had betted her because she was there and willing, nothing more. But she was a captivating creature now that he knew more of her. Comely enough, to be sure, but she was devious and cunning,
and did what it took to survive. Oh, he knew that she came to his bed to gain his protection, and nothing more. That was simple enough to grasp. But she lied to him at every turn, and did it well. Certainly she was not the same caliber of liar as that snake Kyrus, but Jinzan also had resources that Dinric lacked. Jinzan had studied her source thoroughly as she slept. He was no novice and could see subtleties in the swirls and whirls of the ether that most others could not discern. He was able to pick up the signs of extensive life extension taking its toll on the power of her source. Oh, it was healthy enough, but starved and weakened. If she was 19 autumns, he was a goblin. But it was her deceptions and will to survive that he admired in her. She was living the life she was given and making her way. He would take her back to Magrin as more than a trophy. His interest in her was genuine. She might encounter some small hostility, being Kadrin born, but Magrin was nothing if not accepting, and his standing was more than sufficient to validate her among the elite of the kingdom. Jinzan reached into his pocket, feeling the cold, hard surface of the tiny cannon that was secreted away within. Another pocket held a bag filled with tiny cannonballs, and a pouch contained black powder, wadding, a powder horn, ram, and swab. He had pilfered the material from the goblin batteries and used his magic to shrink them down. It was exacting magic, using the ether to crush everything down equally and lightening it proportionally. The little cannon kit moved awkwardly as he fiddled with the pieces. They were intact cannon components, just compressed, and every bit of them was still there. The portion of the spell that made them feel manageably light was not quite as precise, and the pieces did not handle as if they were miniatures made to be the size they were. Awkward or not, they were the key to his plan. If anything went wrong with the battle, he would not have to rely on the goblins giving him the use of one of the cannons as they fought for their lives. The first of the wolves reached the mountain road up to Rainsdark. Unable to scale the low cliffs that separated the switchbacks, they were forced to weave back and forth as the road wended its way up toward the city gate. Built for defense, Rainsdark had only the one gate. Arrows fired down from what remained of the wall, expertly picking off the wolves as they ran sidelong to the wall. The armored helmets for the reckless goblin cavalry were designed to protect them as they mounted a frontal charge. The Kadrin arrows were finding flanks left bare to allow for speed.
"Help me with him! Get him down to the ground!" one of the lookouts said, holding a slumping Iridan under the arms.
His third firestorm had taken from his own source for ether and left him spent. He was conscious but exhausted and was ready to fall off the wreckage of the tower he had taken up position on if no one else was ready with aid. Having seen the aid his magic had been, spearmen rushed over to help lower Iridan to the ground level, hoping fervently that he would be able to rejoin the battle. The more of the goblins he slew, the fewer that they would have to fend off. Iridan's head lolled to the side as he was handed down into the waiting arms of Duke Peloton's troops. Brannis spared a glance after his friend's well-being, but he had to focus on the enemy and the command of his own troops.
"Fool, you did it to yourself again. At least this time you did not burn yourself unconscious."
Brannis gritted his teeth in frustration, wishing his friend had learned better control over his power, or was at least more judicious with it.
"Catapults! All fire!"
Brannis shouted back to the siege crews. The infantry was in range, and he could not let the opportunity pass as he checked on whether Iridan would be in any condition to rejoin the battle.
Creak! Thing!
The catapults loosed sacks full of gravel from the mines, left open such that the gravel lofted free as the sacks arced through the air. The crews were supplied with countless sacks of the stuff, a waste product that was built up and eventually hauled out of the city to be dumped. Brannis had just ordered the process to be carried out by catapult and had designated the goblin army as the dumping ground. Much of the gravel was landing on the lower portion of the road as well, possibly impeding the goblin advance.
As Brannis looked to the west, he saw an absolute sea of goblins. More and more emerged from the fog, which had persisted all the way to sunset. The estimates from the survivors of Illard's Glen had been woefully inaccurate. There were likely already 60,000 goblins upon the plain, and who knew how many more yet to emerge. Yet even with the walls in ruins, the city was defensible, and the humans still held advantages in reach and strength when the battle was joined in hand combat.
We have waited out their bombardment. We have forced them to face us. Now is our chance to drive them back and throw them off the mountain as they try to take it from us, Brannis shouted, trying to steel the courage of men who had never seen real combat.
He glanced down the lines, spearmen four deep, archers still picking their shots as the dwindling pack of wolf riders grew closer. None had broken yet and fled in the face of the enemy. None were crying, at least audibly, or talking of retreat. But there were dark looks among those who stood with Brannis, haunted eyes, muttered imprecations, and a few seemed to be catatonic. They might feign bravery well, but Brannis mistrusted them until he saw whether they held against the first charge. When the wolves were nearly upon them, Brannis took up a position at the fore. Avalanche in hand, he stood out among the grim and dreary mail of soldiers and unarmored winter clothing worn by the militia. The sorcerers had the sense to dress in black for battle, and the knight's bright steel and green-on-black livery shone. But Brannis Solaran looked every bit the commander of an imperial army in his gold and quicksilver armor, the polished surfaces reflecting the last moments of sunlight. The wolves came across the rocky ruin at the approach to the wall, fanning out and making a break for the interior of the city. Wolves as large as mules danced like mountain goats across the uneven terrain, few even missing a step as they leaped and sprang from boulder to flat spot to fallen masonry. The growls and snarls as their prey stood waiting were fearsome, and the wolves fearless, and they plowed heedless into the waiting line of spears, trained to trust in their frilled helms and leather armor to keep death from finding them before they dealt it. A golden statue amid 10 soldiers, Brannis was sought out by several wolf riders, eager for the kill of an obviously important commander. The goblin spears deflected harmlessly off his armor as they charged him, not even connecting with enough force to rock him backward, as Rashan's demonstration had. Avalanche swept through the air like one of the goblin swords the Kelvi expedition had brought. But unlike those wisps of steel, his enchanted blade moved with the force of a mountain behind it. Neither wolf nor armor nor goblin rider impeded its path in the slightest. Brannis could only even tell he was finding his target by the sound and the mess. Wolves were cloven in twain. Strikes that hit flat-bladed sprayed buckets of blood and gore across the crushed rock hilltop they defended. Men who had previously bunched close to defend their commander now offered him a wide space. Brannis retreated only against the onslaught of carrion that was piling in front of him. All down the wall, the defenders held their ground. The wolf riders were brave and foolhardy, seeking out the well-armored knights in search of trophies rather than probe for weakness among the lines. But their charge had brought time for the infantry behind them. Unlike their mounted comrades, the infantry were climbing the rock faces and heading directly up the side of the mountain toward the fortifications. Brannis and the rest of the Kadrin defenders had no way to know that the whole of the goblin infantry wore special climbing gear. Crude brass claws, cast by the score in the goblin forges, were strapped to the backs of their hands, and toothy spikes dug down from the tips of their boots, giving them bite into the loose rock of the mountain bottom. And, should they reach that far, the masonry pile higher up. Thus they surprised the defenders with the speed at which they ascended, making time up the mountainside quicker than even the wolves had, running fast but needing to follow the road until nearly at the top. The goblins were light, fragile creatures, but what there was of them was mostly muscle and sinew. They were able to pull their own weight up easily as they climbed, and it fatigued them little. Their short, razor-sharp spears could even be clutched in one hand, while the claw strapped to its back held their grip on the rocks. Brannis saw it and knew there was going to be a slaughter the likes of which he had never witnessed. The goblins knew that many of them, perhaps even most of them, had little chance of surviving the earliest phase of the assault, but they knew that their brethren would follow behind and trusted that the humans would wear down and eventually succumb. Brannis could only hope that they were wrong, and that with magic and stamina, they could withstand the onslaught. The battlefield stilled as the goblins paused in their ascent. Goblin and human alike turned to find the source of the great bellow that sundered the air and shook the ground beneath them. Lesser slopes to the north and south of Rainsdark, with no wards to stop them, saw avalanches begin due to the noise. The fog over the goblin campsite dissipated rapidly as a rush of massive wings flapping created a tempest near the Neverthaw River, where it seemed that the command tents were pitched.
Kneel down, humans, and face your doom. I am Jadefire, goddess of these, my loyal followers. And you die at my command.
A mammoth dragon bellowed in excellent Kadrin, going so far as to use the name that humans knew her by, or at least once did some centuries past. With a great beating of wings, the monstrous dragon took to the air. The massive silhouette as she ascended was awe-inspiring, even at the great distance separating the defenders from her. Scale was difficult to judge, but it was so far away, and still looked so large.
Fall back! Take up defense of the streets! Use the houses! Keep the houses between you and the dragon's fire! Brannis ordered.
His troops needed little prompting to abandon the wall, and the scant cover it would offer against an aerial assault. His challenge would be to get them to stop and fight, rather than head for the Undercity. Iridan, still weak enough that he needed help being moved, fumbled inside his tunic for the stone Roshan had given him.
Fighting against the two soldiers who had lifted him up and carried him from where he had taken respite at the base of one of the fallen towers.
Juliana heard the dragon's roar and thought that the wall she had just finished sabotaging was about to give way beneath her. The wall held, but just barely. Its sturdy stone construction was enough, even without the aid of the wards, that it held the advance of the ice against the disruption caused by Jadefire's bellow. She watched as the dragon took wing, and two hints were quite enough for her to decide to take leave of her vantage. She looked down from the wall to the city streets far below. The wall rose 100 and more feet above the top of the cliff wall, which itself stood 40 feet from the level ground of the Overcity. The gate to the Undercity was directly beneath her, and there was no provision for getting from where she was to where she was going. She jumped. Her unbound hair streaked behind her as she plummeted, a pennant of reddish gold announcing her own charge toward the ground. The frigid air was both exhilarating and numbingly cold at the same time, and she relished it. To all appearances, she slammed into the cobblestone path to the Undercity with enough force to splatter her body like the unfortunate wolves that crossed the path of Brannis's sword. Instead, she spiked down into the street on one knee, with a hand out to steady herself. Magic had cushioned her fall, of course, a spell she knew well enough to trust to it mid-fall and silently cast. She considered joining the fighting, but thought better of it.
I am no warlock. I can keep my head on my own shoulders if it comes to a fight. But in a war, I am not prepared to stand out there amid the chaos and trust my magic to keep me alive.
Instead, Juliana contented herself to loiter in the gate area. She was still under cover in case the avalanche wall gave way, but had a view of the streets of Rainsdark and enough of a view to know if the army was being routed or not. She would also be able to hear any further proclamations from the dragon.
If any portion of the claim is called into question, you have but to request my presence, and I will appear with all haste, the knight spoke. He wore no armor and carried no sword within the emperor's audience chamber. Sir Kalar Montague wore his family's coat of arms upon his tabard. Green swords, crossed facing north and west, upon a white shield, and the fashions of a court dandy about the rest of him. Wide sleeves, green hose, and pointed shoes that turned up slightly at the tip. Roshan was disgusted by him. Sir Kalar had just spent half the morning delivering the claim of his lord's cousin, sired by Emperor Darris's uncle Maolin. They had brought birth records, accounts of interviews with the lord's staff, the travel itinerary of the emperor's uncle on and around the time of the conception, and sketches drawn by some artist that Lord Eivwind sponsored that purported to be both hauntingly lifelike and clearly show the resemblance to the boy's supposed sire. Roshan had stood next to the emperor's throne, a position he had attended on more court audiences than he cared to count. As regent, he felt it unseemly to take his seat upon the vacant throne, particularly as he heard one among the dozens of claims that were beginning to flow in from across the empire. He was frankly astonished at the lengths the nobles went to document and verify their ruddings, both legitimate and otherwise. Astonished and sickened, they took no pride in their breeding, leaving to chance what sorts of nobles they ended up with as the generations passed, to say nothing of the emperors it engendered when tragedies such as this occurred. The knight's claim on his master's behalf was at least well presented, if not wholesome and reassuring. Roshan suspected that there may have been dark dealings in the deaths of those who may have been able to present more legitimate claims. The inner circle had likely been taking its time and slowly culling the royal line out of the nobility, but he could prove nothing. His general calling for all claims on the throne was trouble from the start, as he knew it would be. He promised that no claimant should face retribution for bringing their case, however tangential, so long as they made no false representations to him. He also promised protection of all claimants in the form of a personal investigation of any strange deaths. An army arriving at one's castle gate and demanding to conduct an investigation was wholly anathema to a noble house. It affronted their dignity and took the shine from their reputation, guilty or not, and there was nothing to be done about it save meeting the army in the field. A warlock arriving at one's castle gate and demanding to conduct an investigation was, if possible, less welcome. Whereas armies tended to be subject to misdirection, bribery, and a rather unfortunate reputation for rigid thinking, warlocks were notoriously difficult to persuade to any path but the one they had chosen, and saw through ruses too often and too easily. "Very well, Sir Kalar. I accept your claim as truth until such time."
"Draga!"
A voice in Roshan's head screamed, interrupting his thoughts before being abruptly cut off.
"Curse that shoddy stone. I ought to have put more time into its crafting."
"As I have reason to believe otherwise." Roshan finished his previous sentence after a brief hesitation. "I am afraid I must attend to an urgent military matter. I will hold audience in 3 days' time." Roshan figured that would be enough time to deal with whatever had befallen at Rainsdark. It seemed that the goblins had brought along one of their dragon gods. It was an unusual addition to a goblin assault, and an unfortunate one. Dragons were lazy, indolent creatures, content to remain idle for scores of summers at a time, while their minions amassed wealth to give to them in tribute. However, for all their sloth, dragons were the most ferocious creatures imaginable. The goblins would have been wiped from the lands entirely long ago had it not been for the pact they had formed with the dragons, elevating them as deities in exchange for protection. For a dragon to join in attacking Rainsdark, there must have been something that it wanted greatly. Despite his great age and vast experience, Roshan had never battled a dragon before, nor even strongly considered it. During his time as warlock,
the first time anyway, Kadrin was feared as a conquering, expansionist empire. None but Lorimar had dared attack them, including the goblins. However, launching an attack on the goblin lands was nothing to be considered. While a single dragon taking initiative to attack a Kadrin city was troubling, invading them and having all the dragons of the pact allied against him was unquestionably stupid, unthinkable even. He knew he would need to gather ether before he left. The transference spell by itself required massive amounts of ether, and the area around the palace was always a bit dry of ether to begin with. Not to be helped with so many sorcerers about. After that, he would need a reserve in case he ended up in the thick of battle immediately upon arrival. He had no misconceptions about sneaking up on a dragon, or even the goblins, quite frankly, when using a transference spell. They just caused too much disruption in the ether to pass unnoticed by anyone sensitive to it. It was sorely tempting to draw the ether right out of the sources of the useless slackwits that had been inflicted upon him. Of all those at court, he could count a handful worth the space they took up. Lord Durg was a shrewd and keen man. The Duchess Winsaka had sent a reliable knight to court in Sir Darwi, and there were a pair of house sorcerers he would have much liked to recruit
back into the Imperial Circle.
Perhaps a few others, but no more than that few. It was tempting to rid himself of them and use their ether to go into battle with. But no, he would not. Murder in the name of justice, and you might find yourself ruling a kingdom. Murder in the name of convenience, and you find yourself a pariah, no matter how powerful. He might hold the empire together for a while through fear, but eventually alliances would form against him, and he would not survive the aftermath. Instead, Rashan dashed down the stairs of the dais and quick-stepped across the large audience chamber, watching as a path presented itself in the direction he faced, courtiers elbowing and jostling each other to remove themselves from his way. A few tried to ask questions or favors of the regent as he passed, but he studiously ignored them. I am in charge, at least for now. When I say an audience is at an end, there are no further petitions. Once free of the press of bodies in the audience chamber, and free of the rather ill-defined obligation to maintain decorum, he broke into a run. The dark jest he had played out in his head about the sources of those courtiers had given him an idea. The lizard was an obstinate beast, unused to the weight of a human on its head. It bore Jinzan's heft, but disliked having to. The lizard and rider were both camouflaged with magic, appearing as little more than a distortion of the air to those at a distance, no more substantial than the wavy look the air gets above a fire. The complex system of bladders and tubes that wound around the lizard to keep warm was well heated by Jinzan's ether, and the creature carried him, but he had to take a harsh hold on its reins to keep its willfulness in check.
He had taken it on a northerly vector,
heading away from the main body of the goblin army. The walls were not so damaged to that side of the city, where worked stone met unworked. The cannoneers had wanted to breach the central area of the wall to best make use of the road for the approach, and the far northerly and southerly ends of the wall had taken fewer shots than had the rest. But it was to the north that his destination lay, between the city wall and the castle. There was an entrance to the old upper mines. There was no map that showed the location of the staff of Galen, but it was known to be in the upper mines.